Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Calavita. Think outside the bottle with Calavita, America's trusted family brand, makers of extra virgin olive oil and fine Italian food products. Calavita.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Food Talk. Michael Lameco here. Great to be back. Great to be here in the studio. Man, I'm watching people. One thing about this radio station is it's not really a radio station, is it? It's kind of an internet radio station thing in the back of Roberta's in a shipping container, which adds to the quaintness. And we're in Bushwick, which is like the hipster capital of planet Earth, I think, at this point. But we have a big window, so we get to watch the dining room. And this dining room that I'm looking at, in a couple of weeks, they're going to put a wood stove in the middle. And that's going to be the heat for the building, which is pretty funny. But I'm watching this couple, and they're doing something. They're eating pizza with a knife and fork, man. And I saw somebody yesterday. Do you know the Speedy Romeo? Oh, Speedy Romeo. Over Lower East Side in Brooklyn. It's a great spot. Oh, completely wood-fired kitchen. They have no gas. And their pizza is great. And he had been filming in Williamsburg, and I biked to Williamsburg for the shoot all day long, and I kind of wanted to come home and watch the debate last night because, I don't know, I'm just feeling like political.
That's what I did.
Whatever. So the guys wanted to hang out and have drinks after the shoot, and I'm like, you know what? I want to bike home. I'm going to grab a pizza at Speedy, and I'm going to watch the debate. I'll take a shower, and I really want to see this thing live. So I'm at Speedy, and while I'm waiting, you know, the chef comes out, and he's talking. He hooks me up with some wings and some other stuff. And I'm watching, and there's this, like, big table of kids, and they're eating pizza with, like, a knife and fork. And I'm like, God, no, pick that shit up. Anyway, my guest today is Jenny Lefcourt, who is half of, but no longer half of, now she's all of, Jenny and Francois. So Jenny and Francois is a wine importer. Oh, yeah, I should warn everybody. Sorry. This whole hour is going to be about wine today. The whole hour. Jenny Lefcourt is here for the first half hour, and Aurelio Montes is here from Chile to talk about his wines, which are pretty amazing story down there. But Jenny's thing has been since the beginning, since day one, a long time ago. We'll get her story from her, to have a portfolio initially of just French, but all natural wines. And we're going back. What year did you launch?
Yes, indeed. Well, thanks for having me, Mike.
It's a pleasure. I'm so a big fan of your portfolio.
I love Roberta's. I love you.
Thanks so much.
To be thanks on so the radio. My daughter pointed at the radio this morning. She said, "You're going to be on that?" I said, "Well, maybe
well,
that.
Well, actually that. Pointed to the Mac."
Exactly.
What's the radio? That's so analog. No, you don't want
that. We wake up to the radio.
Yeah, I listen to NPR, and I listen to some other couple of stations. But radios, it's sad that radio's gone the way of the horse-drawn carriage for the most part.
Yeah.
It's full of vitriol and nonsense. But anyway, pleasure to have you. So
Thank you.
Year did you launch the company?
So we started the company in 2000.
Whoa, 16 years ago. Was there anybody doing natural wines exclusively then? I mean, Dresdner was leaning that way.
So Dresdner was leaning that way, and Dresdner has never called it natural wine.
Right,
he likes
correct.
Real wine.
Well,
which is a great word as well.
Right, but kudos to them, because they've really, I mean, he always, RIP, he always had a great palate. He was driven. I mean, that's what he would say to me was, you know, I never went out seeking these things. It's
right.
Just when I found a producer that I liked and I liked their wine, it often turned out, oh, so you're a natural winemaker.
That's that's our same story. And it's interesting because there's now, you know, newbies or not so newbies anymore, but there's a lot of people doing what we do now, bringing in all natural wine portfolios. And it's interesting hearing everyone tell the same story. And I'm sure it was interesting to Dresner hearing me talk as if I had discovered this wonderful world that he had been working in already for 10, 15 years, something like that, before we started.
And Kermit was kind of in the periphery. I mean, Kermit was very influential in terms of in the early days at Beaujolais.
Absolutely. Actually, Phil Sarrell, who works in our company, who's a great part of my team these days and has just brought in a bunch of Austrian wines for us, he is the one claim to fame to have put Marcel Lapierre, a bottle of Marcel Lapierre, in front of Kermit and said, try this.
Well, that was an aha fucking moment. Yeah. I would have loved to have been there for that. So now, that was really kind of the beginning there. And it's funny you mentioned Austria, because I think you're having an event coming up at Contra. But I think it's funny, because when I think of Austria, I almost think the other way. It's like kind of emblematic of very modern winemaking in terms of technically modern winemaking.
Exactly. I'm a wine geek in terms of drinking wines that give me pleasure, and I've always stuck, for many years, I stuck to France and stuck 100% to France and have branched out, you know, when I realized Tony Cottori needed representation in New York City, I thought, okay, this is going to completely redefine what we do. Are we ready for it? Mm-hmm. And that was our first sort of leap outside of France. But Austrian wines, you know, I still have tons and tons to learn. But it was really going to specific bottles that made me say, okay, actually, yes, our company is ready for this because they're doing incredible, interesting things, and this is the forefront of the natural wine movement.
So what was it like? So the year's 2000. You're going out on a limb. You were in the wine business before. You were working for another company. You were on the floor at
I was not in the wine business at all. I was doing a PhD in French film and literature at Harvard University.
Oh, God, you're one of them.
Place in Boston.
Holy shit. Well, that's fantastic and great. And we could talk film and cinema sometime.
Exactly.
And really bore down.
I wrote a 450-page dissertation on early French film.
How cool.
And while I was in Paris...
I always liked... What's the guy? Jean Gabin. I always liked him. He was in those Renoir movies. I always liked that guy's face.
Oh,
he was
heartthrob, yes.
Yeah, wasn't he cool? He was like the French Bogart. Or the
exactly.
French that sort of... Not a handsome guy per se, but there was something about him, like a salt of the earth human being.
Rustic, like a natural wine.
Yeah, I always saw Jean Gabin. It's funny. I like a bromance. Well, I guess I didn't know him, so it can't be a bromance. Right? That's my kind of guy. I like that kind of guy. Anyway, so we're not talking about French cinema. So you come out of that, and then you need a job.
So, yeah, then I needed a job. I was finishing up my dissertation. There was one job available in French literature and film in Minnesota, and I thought, that job is the most desirable job, and I actually don't want it. I want to stay in Paris or New York or Burgundy or the Loire or somewhere like that. And I had begun to taste and discover wines in restaurants, wine bars in Paris. I had begun to go to wine tastings and talk to winemakers.
So this is funny. So you're in your early 20s already,
mm-hmm.
and you're not really a wine person yet, but you're just kind of being drawn in from the periphery.
Exactly.
That's like Pascaline's story. You know that, right?
It is. Like, I knew
she was a philosophy. She grew up in the Loire Valley, so you'd assume, but no. You know, I mean, yeah, they drank wine in the house, but it was not something they talked about. It wasn't like something
right.
that would draw. And she was a great academic. She was, I think, postgraduate philosophy, and then got into wine in her early 20s.
That's right. Pascaline Lepelletier. I met her when she was living in Paris, already working for Rouge Tomate, and we had a lot in common because
we both
came from academic backgrounds and non.
Right.
Although she grew up in the Loire, so she had a foot in it.
And she has made up for it, boy. If I see one more hashtag from Pascaline, Shannon, and she tortures me. Now that Luge is open, and every night we get our Facebook feed of her choice selection of 8 or 9 bottles
right
of the night.
To Rouge Tomate.
Yes.
Glass of
Chenin
Blanc. So I was living in Paris, drinking wine, studying and watching films, and I thought, how can I make this life go on? This is the life that I love. I'm loving it. And so I figured it out, and I brought some bottles of wines I had tried to New York. And I said, are these here? These are not here. And I started looking around New York for all these wines that I was drinking in France, and I didn't see them anywhere. So one day I had gone to a natural wine tasting. At the time, nobody used the word natural, but we were starting to ask questions. How come this wine tastes so delicious? Why is it so different? Why is the aromatic palate so open? Why does it taste different at the end of the meal from the beginning of the meal and just give us so much pleasure and speak to us like a person who we're getting to know? What is this? And the more questions we asked, the more we realized that the wines we loved were all made the same way. That is, they were organically grown grapes.
Right, so we're talking about proper farming practices.
This is not
big agro. This is not fertilizer. This is not spraying chemicals. This is not copper everywhere. This is learning how to farm naturally. So exactly. The soil is healthy. The vines themselves are healthy.
Healthy soil, healthy grapes, well-balanced grapes. Right. Because the truth is, once you stop adding all those chemicals to the soil, you have a better balanced grape. It's shown now that there's more acidity in a grape. So actually, it leads to better quality wine because acidity is the backbone of wine. It what makes it be able to age. And so we were going around talking to winemakers and asking more and more questions, and all of them said, yes, well, I grow grapes organically, but then in the cellar, I also use nothing. I don't buy yeast. I don't add too much sulfur. I don't filter. I don't use new wood. I don't add tartaric acid.
Just non-interventionist is another term that we hear.
Yes. But I didn't go and say, oh, I'm going to start an organic wine importing company. I just went and said, wow, who are these incredible farmers who are, you know, making these gorgeous wines that give me so much pleasure, and why aren't they in the U.S.?
And I should just stop you for a second. I never know who's listening, and I figure, you know, all seven of you. You know, we get a lot of psalms on this show. We get winemakers on the show. We talk a lot about wine on this show. But it occurred to me, like, somewhere 8 or 9 years ago when I began to drink a lot more natural wines, that I began to think, holy shit, I've been, like, when I go to a wine store somewhere in America that it maybe doesn't have natural wines, 99% of what I have on the shelf is the following. It's factory farming, so you have no soil health. I don't even go into, like, irrigation and yields, but you could be looking at overcropped vines. It's like factory farming anything. So then they pick those grapes, which are probably mechanically harvested, so there's no selection there. They kill whatever, if there were any yeast, that they're inoculated. And then they're buying from a catalog that's out there of thousands of types of yeast. Oh, what kind of Sauvignon Blanc would you like?
Exactly.
Would you like this? Would you like that? And they're using a yeast that's an external yeast. And there's dozens of other things. We can chaptalize. We can remove acid. We can use gum arabic if it's too. And there's a million dirty tricks in winemaking that get done all the time. And then did we get into sulfur yet? No. And then you have these bottles of stuff that's being sold as wine that's really kind of gross.
It's grape products.
It's basically, I mean, you can add coloring.
Drinks made with a base of
grapes. Right, grape juice that turned into this because we can do that with our bag of tricks.
It's a scandal, and it's a scandal that's not talked about as much as it should be. Michael Pollan is the advocate in terms of
food,
pointing out what is going on with the food industry and uncovering the woes of industrial agriculture and agrobusiness. And in the wine world, the problem is that there's a lot of money put into advertising for big wine companies, and these small farmers who are making the best wines around and not polluting the earth and making pleasurable wines and who care about the final taste and the health and pleasure of their customers, they don't have money to advertise for themselves. That's where we come in. We're trying to talk about what they do. But it is really the only food or drink that doesn't list additives.
And there are so many. And it's not just, I mean, you can put, before it becomes wine, you could get that grape juice and put it through reverse osmosis, separate it into solids and liquids. You can add alcohol, you can de-alcohol. I mean, you could, honestly, they could just make shit.
Yeah.
And there's so many, and you, like you said, you don't have to add the additives. I mean, you know, there's
200 permissible additives permissible in winemaking.
Colorants, color removals, acids that you can add, acid that you can take. I mean, it's like when you bore down, when you read more about it, you talk to winemakers, it's crazy.
It's crazy. And, you know, wineries are big, huge polluters, too.
Yeah.
They're huge polluters. It's the biggest polluters in France, for example. And, you know, people think, oh, the beautiful vineyards. Most pictures of vineyards I see, I think, are like the ugliest things I've ever seen.
Looks like Mars with like these twigs sticking out of them.
Monoculture.
It's complete monoculture. There's no there's nothing. It's true. And I think probably the worst of it, because I'm old enough to remember like going to Bordeaux in the 70s and walking around. I think that was probably, you know, I think the French were making natural wines, and so were the Italians. So I think for most of the history of wine making,
yes,
they were making natural wines.
Yes.
We don't know when sulfur started to be added, but it was somewhere in the last century. Oak wasn't really used really until after World War II. I mean, I had always assumed that going back for centuries, the Bordelais had these barrique and they toasted. No. So
nobody could afford new oak barrels.
Correct. So,
and sulfur was created by chemical companies after World War I.
Correct.
You know, then that was modified and changed and concentrated.
And fertilizer was, a lot of that was coming out of petroleum producer. So the French, I mean, most of Europe was making natural wines forever until after World War II. And then even then, everyone was so beat up and broke that. But as money began to fall into their coffers in the 60s and the 70s, that sort of became like the worst era for winemaking, because then they could afford everything. Then they could buy pesticides and fertilizers and all the junk that you needed post-crush to create things.
Yeah. I mean, it's not necessarily an easy life living in the countryside in France in the 60s and 70s. Yeah. And, you know, so chemical sales people came along and said, you know, this is going to make your life easier.
Right.
Here's some Roundup. Like, why? Right. You don't want to be pulling your weeds or using a horse to plow.
Right.
And so,
and the truth was, you know, here too in America, the food scene in our country, I'm not talking about wine yet, but like the food scene in America was horrible. Like, I lived through that. Like, before World War II, there was like butchers and bakers and stuff, and people cooked. And then it got to be like the 60s in the era of like NASA and Mrs. Kennedy, Jackie Kennedy, loved TV dinners. It was like, and women didn't want to do this shit anymore. So it's like,
in a can, you don't have to cook dinner.
I remember literally like half of my friends growing up, like, we drank Tang instead of orange juice because John Glenn had it on the Apollo mission. So instead of squeezing oranges, you were getting this powdered liquid, a powder, pouring water into it, stirring it. I mean, holy fuck, that's where we were too.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's like the whole world kind of crashed down culinarily and wine-wise, and maybe the 70s was like the darkest era, late 60s and 70s. Trust me.
Exactly.
I was there. So, all right,
too.
So that's what you got. So that's what got you into it. And it's so funny you and Pascaline go back that far. Where do you stand? So sulfur, SO2 is a really interesting thing.
Yes.
So it's used in a couple of places for a couple of reasons in winemaking. It can be used to stop fermentation when you decide you're done. Introduce SO2, it's finished.
So,
Then at bottling.
Yeah.
Bottling for stability. Traditionally, it's in some dosages, depending on how many mils per liter or parts per mil per liter. It's used for bottling to stabilize the wines historically. Yeah. But it can also be super abused. And a lot of people are using none.
So
talk about SO2.
To me, I mean, when people talk about natural wine, SO2 seems to be the buzzword and the topic that comes up that's under the most debate. But the basic thing is, people are not using chemicals in the vines on the earth, so they're not polluting. They're making organically grown grapes, so that's really important. Then they get to the cellar, and what do they do? And there are, you know, more industrial type organic vineyards, bigger vineyards, that will then get those grapes to the cellar and put sulfur on the grapes to kill off whatever bacteria and yeast are present, and then they choose their lab yeast, which could have a certain taste or be more neutral.
But you're not going to consider that natural.
Right. This is the point at which
I mean, if it's not using natural yeast, it's not. To me, if it's not natural, if it's not native yeast, it's not natural wine.
Exactly.
A, that's number
so
one.
This is the first definition of natural wine. So they get to the cellar with their organically grown grapes or biodynamically grown grapes, and they're going to make wine. And so for those who are using indigenous yeast, the yeast that's there, you can see it with your eyes on the skin of the grape that is from the vineyard, from the place.
Right.
From the vintage.
Right. So if you're a believer in terroir, you can't get more terroir specific than that's the yeast from my ground
that's
really specific to this spot.
That's where the story is going to come from. Right. That yeast is going to talk to us in the bottle.
Right.
So that's going to make the fermentation happen. That's going to make the specificity of this wine.
Because
so if you come in and you add a lab yeast that tastes like, you know,
bananas.
Bananas is the most... You know, Beaujolais Nouveau, everyone says, oh, it tastes like bananas. It's because everyone uses the same yeast.
Yep.
So when
you all of George DeBoeuf's wines taste the same, actually.
They taste the same.
It's not even just his Nouveau. Every one of them tastes the same. I don't care what he calls them. It's like banana, banana, banana one, banana two, banana three.
If you taste a good Beaujolais that's made with indigenous yeast next to that, it's completely different, much more complex. There'll be that cherry that's there or the fruit that's there because it's a young wine because it's made from a Gamay grape, but it won't always be this one thing of bananas. So you have a natural wine, it's made with indigenous yeast. Then, so sulfur, there's a lot of sulfur that is permissible in winemaking. And the way sulfur is used is the harvest comes in. Most winemakers put sulfur directly on the grapes. They kill off the yeast, they kill off the bacteria, and as the fermentation goes along, they need to add more because it combines with the wine as it's fermenting, and it disappears, and it won't protect the wine from oxygen anymore, which is what it's for. It's to protect against bacteria, it's to protect against oxygen. That's the fight of winemaking, is protecting, you know, not too much oxygen, not too little oxygen. So you have to add more and more and more to protect the wine as it goes along, and then more before bottling to protect it while it's in the bottle. And you can end up with 200 milligrams per liter.
Which is pretty astonishing, because like most of what I'm drinking, some of what I'm drinking has none, depending on the producer. And then like most of what I'm drinking, when I pull out the spec sheets, like if I'm going to Alsace and I'm drinking Just My Air, or I'm drinking Umbrecht, you know, they would love in a perfect world not to use any sulfur, but they kind of want to be certain that if they're producing 50,000 cases a year and they're shipping 15 to 20 to America, that wine's going to, 12 bottles will be identical in each case, and each case will be like the case that came before it and after it.
But
we're talking like 10, 12, 14.
Christian Binaire, who we work with in Alsace, most of the time uses no sulfur whatsoever. He makes beautiful, beautiful wines. Once in a while, he'll put a crown cap on something and say, this is a sparkling wine, because that's the way the wine went, and it's delicious. As long as it's called Frizzante, everyone's happy. So you don't need 200 milligrams.
Right.
You know? So if you're using indigenous yeast, you can't do that. So you can put a little before bottling. That will protect it as much
and
as...
Give me a little as in like 8, 10, 12, up to what?
Up to 20.
Right. That's what that seems to be what...
So
Isabelle Legeron, same thing. Okay.
The truth is that's the same amount of free sulfur that you'll have in a 200 milligram total sulfur bottle. So, because all the rest of the sulfur has combined in the techno one that, you know, so they're both protected equally. And there's also actually sulfur that's naturally there.
Yeah.
And so the wine could be protected with adding nothing. You know, the winemaker knows if his or her wine is already protected. It's gone through everything it's going to go through. It's been exposed to oxygen. Nothing more is going to happen. They can safely bottle it. It's a healthy, beautiful, well-made, balanced wine, and bottle it with no sulfur, and it will be fine. Other wines might need a little bit. You know, that's up to the winemaker.
Right. It could be depending on the year. It could be depending on the weather at the time. Because there's all of these variables.
If there was some rot.
Right.
If there was, you know, and they select, you know, all our winemakers will go through and get all that rot out and do careful selection of grapes to be able to make natural wine. I mean, that's why the wines end up so good, is because they're so, so careful, because they want to be as natural as they can. So they don't want to add sulfur if they can help it. But many will add before bottling a little bit, but 20 is not the same thing as 200. And, you know, the truth is, in the 200 milligram sulfur bottle, you know, you also have the added lab yeasts and many other things probably. And so the end result is going to be completely different.
Yeah, it is. And I before we were, you know, we were talking before the mic went live, and I was saying that, so I kind of, because of friends like Alice Firing and because I met Pascaline at the old Rouge Tomat and know a lot of Psalms, you know, I began to sort of put my toe in the natural wine world. Oh, maybe after you, maybe, probably 04, 05, 06 is more like it for me. And it was kind of hit or miss. You know, when the early days of Ten Bells, I'd go, and I remember the guy that used to own it that was behind the bar, and, you know, he'd be pouring me stuff, and I'm like, what the f-? You know, it's just Brett's flying off. I have no idea what varietal I'm drinking. You know, we're decanting it an hour later. It's still Brett City, and sometimes the wines were mousy, and sometimes they were vinegar, and sometimes it was, and I'm like, what? I don't, but talk about the, because it's a relatively new thing, how the winemaking has gotten better. Because now my palate, I mean, now I'm really drawn to seeking out natural wines all the time, because I just find that there is a vivacity to them. There's just, they're, it's a living organism.
Yeah.
And that bottle will change with from glass to glass, from the first part of the glass to the second part of the glass. It'll change over the course of hours. Sometimes if I don't finish them over the course of days, it keeps moving. And it's like having a conversation. This thing is alive for a lot of reasons. There's, if it's not fined and filtered, there's still lees in there. There's still yeast left over. I mean, it's a living thing.
It's a living thing. And the point of that living thing is pleasure. So, right. I mean, whether, however a wine is made, if it doesn't give us pleasure, then there's no,
right.
there's
What's
no
the point?
Point. What's the point? To me, I never was particularly interested in wine until I got to France and somebody put what I now know as natural wine in front of me. And I tasted it and I said, What?
You know,
why
thing?
Is this
right.
so alive? Why is this so delicious?
It's funny.
Like, has acidity, but it has fruit, but it has,
right.
you know, some kind of,
and something, an energy to it. There's a tension in there that's
herbaceousness or salinity or whatever it
it's
is.
It's funny. I was talking to Isabel Legeron, who's going to have, so we should talk about, shout out, there's this big natural wine fair coming up called Raw. First one ever in America, right?
Yes.
In it's going to be in Brooklyn, in Bushwick, the Jefferson Stop, some venue. I don't know. It looks like an auto body shop. I don't know. This is Bushwick, man. But it's 2 days. It's November 6th and 7th?
Yes.
Tickets are available. It's going to be amazing. If you don't know Isabel Legeron, you Google her, Legeron. She's a master of wine, French by birth, British, Britain is where she lives now. She has a great book out on natural wine. And I was talking to her at Rouge Tomat a couple of weeks ago. And I was talking about, you know, the same conversation we're having. And she had this great description of it. This is, but I was talking about like the old style of, I mean, what happened, like what Bordeaux was doing in the 60s and 70s and maybe into the 80s. But, and she said, you know, it's really with sulfur and with all of that chemical for, it was, the wine's real, it was like mummified wine.
That's a good way of putting it.
And I thought that's such a good way to put it. So it's like, let's embalm, let's preserve this thing as much as we can so it stays the same.
That's how I always feel. I'm like, something is blocking me from enjoying this. I can't get to the wine. The wine is like behind something.
Yeah, and then that word, when she used mummification,
that's,
I'm like,
great.
Actually, that's a great way to put it, because the light goes on your head. Because that's sort of, that's like, these wines are alive and these wines are decaying really. Really slowly.
Yeah.
So what's going on in America now with natural wine? What's happening in this country? I'm going to have an hour with Tony Couture, which I'm terrified about, because I'm going to be
great.
In a room of people that know more about wine than I do.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Tony's this character. But so what's happened? Because Tony was like this crazy, like hippie ex-San Francisco. He's been doing this since like day one in the 70s.
Yeah,
in
I
Sonoma.
Feel so lucky to represent him here in New York. Well, he's been at it forever. I mean, what's interesting is when we started out, we worked with wineries from many regions in France. So there'd be Marc Pinot in the Loire, or Magalie Terrier in Corbière. I mean, now Tony Couture in California. And people felt isolated and alone. And they said, what am I doing in my region? Everyone's, you know, at least like in Muscadet, everyone's machine harvesting. You know, they really want to have as much crop as they can. And they're making wine in a totally different way for me. Here I am by myself. And then there started to be these fairs, Dives Bouté in France. Mm-hmm. And we had, you know, started with our Natural Winemaker Week in New York. And brought a lot of winemakers together who had never spent so much time with other winemakers who were like-minded. And so a lot of exchange of information, how do you make wine? What do you do? What do you do if you have this problem and that problem? Everyone started talking to each other, and there were more and more fairs all over France. Now all over Europe, and now in New York.
Yeah, it's going to be great. So this is November 6th and 7th. It's the RAW. It's the Raw Wine Festival or something like that. Googled on the internet. Isabelle Legendre is the brains behind it. There's some great panel discussions. I mean, Pascaline will be there with Alice Firing talking about terroir, which is... they're working on something about it. Trust me, there's a book in this. There's a bunch of great panels, a bunch of great psalms, and all of the wines are going to be natural wines, so you're going to be drinking natural wines, meeting the winemakers. It's just going to be a great two-day experience. Thanks for coming in. But we could have burned up an hour easily.
Wow. Thank you for having me.
Jenny Lefcourt has been my guest. When you're looking for wines in a store, spin the bottles around. If you see Jenny and Francois is the importer, that's her. Buy the bottle. No questions asked. It's going to be killer. It's going to be natural. It's going to be delicious. It will bring you pleasure. Stay tuned. I've got Aurelio Montes coming on next to talk about what's going on with his amazing winery down in Chile. And this next 2 minutes will just be some people that help bring this show possible every season, and also some of the other shows here at Heritage. So stay tuned for more wine talk right after this.
Music for this commercial break is brought to you by Teeth People, and this track is called Greenwood Cemetery.
Hey folks, Mike Halameko here. Everybody knows that great cooking really starts with great ingredients, and these days we have so many options to choose from. Well, I go back to the Cola Vida family brand for years, and there really is a Cola Vida family behind this brand. I got their story long after I started using their products. Back in the mid-80s, when I was the chef at the Ritz-Carlton here in New York City, one of the things you can do as a chef is order your own food. You do the purchasing, and we switched olive oils to Cola Vida. When I had my own restaurant down in Cape May, New Jersey, the Globe, for years, that's all we ever poured at the table. That's all I ever cooked with. And then when I started my PBS show in 1999, I thought, you know, if I'm going to look after underwriting and funders, why don't I go after products that I actually use at home, that I actually cook for my family with and in my restaurant with. I've been working with them for 15 years with the PBS series and now with Heritage Radio. The Cola Vida family goes back generations in Italy. They make their olive oil from great sourced olives, traceable source olives, just south of Rome in Molise province, Abruzzo, which is where my family hails from. Since then, their family's moved here, so they're Cola Vida's living in Rome. Cola Vida's living in America. It's a great, trusted family brand. It's the olive oil I use, and I'd recommend you try it as well. So when you think of the great wine regions of the world historically, I mean, you're going to be led back to Bordeaux, Burgundy, Champagne, okay, maybe Piedmont, Italy, too. And as a chef growing up, boy, if you were working in great restaurants in the 70s and 80s, they were mostly all French, and we grew up drinking Bordeaux and Burgundy and Champagne with impunity. Well, fast forward to today, and I just got back from the 2015 Bordeaux harvest. We were there for a week with a bunch of sommeliers. It was so much fun, and I'll tell you, this isn't your grandfather's Bordeaux. There's a whole new generation of young vignerons working with this great terroir that they've lived on, this soil that they know that they've grown up with, and the great varietals that we all know and love, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Cab Franc, Petit Verdot, Malbec. You know, this style of Bordeaux now that's younger, that's fresher, that's meant to be consumed now and not cellared, because honestly, which of us has a cellar? And who wants to buy a bottle of wine and wait 10 years? So the Bordeaux whites are amazing. Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon, like, hello, two grapes that we know. The reds are all sorts of different stories, from the left bank style that are a little more Cabernet Sauvignon driven, a little more structured, right bank a little more Merlot, a little easier, a little more upfront friendly. But if you haven't thought about drinking Bordeaux wine, give it another shot. For $15 to $35 in that price range, which is my price range, there's tremendous value in there. So if you're walking past a Bordeaux wild, stop, grab a great bottle. These are some of the most food-friendly wines on planet Earth. Wow, hour of this week's show. I should tell you, next week's going to be a fun show. Next week, I've got it's a pre-tape. I'm not going to be here. I'm out of the town all week. But next week's show, I've got an hour with Virgilio Martinez, who is the chef owner of Restaurant Central in Lima, Peru. He was in town a few weeks ago. We filmed at his restaurant years back. Well, a year and a half ago. I had a great lunch there. I was really impressed with this dude. Super talented guy. Lima is a really interesting food town these days. Thanks to the Peruvian economy sort of coming back and, you know, a middle class that's there again. But if you don't know Virgilio, Google him. He's a really talented guy, really stoked about what he does. And I don't think there's a Michelin guide for that country. And I'm not so big on guides anyway. I don't really care too much. But, you know, the chefs love it. I think his restaurant's ranked third or fourth in the Pellegrino list of best restaurants in the world. So... And he's a young dude. So anyway, in studio today, live with me, is Virgilio Montes, who owns a great winery in Chile, founded in 1988. Great backstory, which I want to get to in 10 seconds. Right now, you're 650,000 cases of wine. You guys are big.
We became big.
We became big, yeah. But you studied agronomy. So how did you get into wine? What was the story? Because it wasn't like you grew up in vineyards.
Not at all. My father was in insurance business, actually. Right. So I studied agronomy in the Catholic University. And within, you know, the career, you have to choose where to go, fruits, cattle, or whatever. And I decided to go to wine because I thought it was something so appealing, so you need so much passion to go to it. And there were not too many, you know, students much interested in that. So I was saying, well, I want to be different. I want to do something else that everyone is doing. So I decided enology. And there I am. You know, God took me by the hand to the most unexplored and unexpected places.
Yeah. Right. Destiny tapped you on the shoulder, as is often the case.
Absolutely.
In life. It's funny.
Absolutely.
We plan. Like, it's funny. I've got kids, so it's like chaos theory, because you kind of do your best with your kids. But then you realize, you look back at your own life and say, you know, when you met your wife, remember how that happened? Or when you got that career change, remember how that happened? Remember that phone call? Remember that day in the elevator? That guy said, aren't you the... And it's like... That was bingo. It's crazy.
Absolutely.
So what was it? So this was the 70s. What was the Chilean wine scene like? What was viticulture? What was happening down there? I honestly don't know.
Yeah, well, actually, we have been, you know, in viticulture since the Spaniards came to Chile.
Makes sense.
You know, in the 1500s. So, but it was very basic, actually. They brought, you know, very basic varieties for the purposes of celebrating Holy Mass. And the varieties were not good enough. In the mid of the 19th century, very rich families that made money, especially in the mining business, they spent summers, you know, in Europe, and they were kind of a little bit trying to copy, you know, the European style. So they started bringing, you know, best varieties like Cabernet, Merlot, Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, and they brought, you know, very famous winemakers, French winemakers, and they built huge and beautiful wineries. So it was a kind of a weird beginning, you know. It was because people wanted to be in fashion, and it was the best way to start, because they didn't care for profit. They were rich already. So they brought the best of best, and they didn't care about profit. And that was the beginning, and it was a good beginning.
What was the first winery that you worked at?
Well, I left university in 1972, and I started working for Unduraga Winery.
I had it written down. I didn't want to mispronounce it. Yeah. I don't know. Are they in the States? I don't know them.
They used to be. Now they are. They became small in this country. So they had a position. But now they have gone really down. So after that, after 12 years, I was invited by San Pedro Winery, that's one of the biggest winery, you know, to work with them as a technical director, both in viticulture and enology. And they changed of ownership, and of course, all the top management was, well, fired. So I was 39, five kids at home, and I said, well, it's time to make a decision. Rather re-employ myself in another winery or start on my own. I had already moved around the world. I knew what the world was demanding. I knew where the good vineyards were in Chile. I knew that it was unfair to produce a basic, interesting wine. I think that Chile deserved to have something much better than that. So I decided to start with Montes, with another three friends, each one covering a different area, financial area, marketing, engineering, and myself as a winemaker.
Did you buy existing vineyards, or did you start planting your own, or a little bit of both? Or
we didn't have a penny. We started from scratch. So because I knew what the good grapes were, because I have been working for 15 years for other companies, I just went to the good vineyards and say, you know, I want to buy that corner. Mm. I want to buy this little bit here. And then we bought little bits and pieces and start, you know, doing the wines and bottling in a very basic way. Myself, even I was bottling, you know, and labeling by hand the first badges.
No, seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we started selling wine and we found out that the market was prepared to receive Chilean wines of a better category at a more fair price. Mm. So I think that I'm proud to say that we showed a way to the Chilean wine industry. There was a much better way than producing a cheap, interesting wine.
The market at that time for Chile, America represented what percentage of your exports?
Well, when I started with Montes in the 1987, roughly, Chile was exporting as a whole only 3% of its production abroad, and the rest all consumed.
Consumed domestically. Okay.
Domestically. Okay. Yeah. So when we started, the American market was our first target, and the first shipping we ever did was to the U.S., to New York, actually. And then we started covering the rest of the countries. And, after 10 years in which our program was to do 30,000 cases, we were doing already 300,000 cases because, you know, the product was totally accepted. You know, the packaging, the price point, the style of wine and everything. And we were already in more than 50 countries around the world. Mm. So we were much more important, and we still are much more important in the international market than in the domestic market. Mm. As we say, no one is a prophet in his own land. You have to go out to be believed. You know, in your own land, no one believes you.
So the grape varietals, you're exclusively French still to this day.
Absolutely.
So you're doing Carmenere, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Syrah, Sauvignon Blanc. What am I missing?
Yeah, but Chardonnay, and we're starting with southern French variety like Sanzo.
You're doing Sanzo now.
The one I have here. A little bit of Carignan, Mourvèdre, Grenache. So, yes, those are basically the other varieties.
And you had a tier structure for the wines. Everybody does. So there's sort of the top end. Talk about them. Because, I mean, you sent down a few bottles to my house, so I had them over the weekend. And they're really big wines. They're really... I'm trying to think of words to describe them in the proper way. Lots of expression of fruit, big. There's oak on a lot of the wines that you use that's integrated, but it's there.
Is that?
So they're kind of, to me, like new world style with old world varietals. Some of them kind of remind me of, like, when you get into the Bordeaux varietals of that. Because are you using barrique? Using French oak?
We're using a lot of French oak. Yes, yeah. Barrique coming from France. And, my philosophy of winemaking is, first of all, totally natural. Although we use sulfur, of course, and we use a lot of the basic things. I don't allow to put any sort of chemicals or bentonites or gelatins, whatever. It's just a couple of winters, you know, that stabilize the wine, and it's ready to go to the bottle. So, first of all, quite natural. Second of all, you know, with low yields. With the low yields, you know, you got a lot of concentration in the juice. And when you got high yields, of course, you know, dilution comes evident there. And we were the first vineyard to plant hillsides. No, I have been already.
So everybody was planting on plains?
Yeah, of course. The valley floor is the easy way to go.
Correct. But it's so funny because when you think... I mean, everywhere I've been in the wine world, to your point, you're right. It's the most natural place to be because it's easier to work those fields. That's where the water runs to, et cetera, et cetera. But then, like, when I think of, like, regions like Sud-de-France, Languedoc-Roussillon, which after World War II, after the Algeria became was no longer France because France used to get a lot of cheap wine from Algeria, the Languedoc-Roussillon became kind of their go-to area. And much of the vineyards were planted the same way. They were planted on valley floors. When I go through parts of Italy, Alto Adige, they used to say, and now everyone wants the slopes. Everybody wants elevation. Yeah. It's just, so as a winemaker, explain that to the people listening, why that matters.
Well, it matters because in the valley, in the slopes, you know, the soil is poorer.
Yeah.
You know, it has been affected by a little bit of erosion through centuries, you know, with the rain and the wind. So the soil is rather poor, number one. Secondly, if you have a heavy rainfall, the water drains out very quickly. So in that sort of soil, poor and less water, as I say, I handle the water because I take it, you know, through pipelines, you know, drip irrigation. But in that case, I play the music and the plant dances. Because I apply the water that I think the plant really needs, not more than that.
Right, and hydric stress, it's funny. We find with winemaking that
it almost...
In the early days of me thinking about, you know, winemaking and grape growing, which becomes wine, you'd think that, well, you'd want happy, well-fed, well-watered, because that's what you do at home to your plants, right? That's what you do with other farms. But the truth is, with vines, it's almost the opposite.
It's opposite.
They like stress, and hydric stress is one. Temperature stress is one. Hydric stress is the less water, the minimal amount of water, keeping those yields low, stressing those vines, that's what produces good wine. Why is that?
Well, because, you know, the plant, you know, concentrates. You lose a lot of water in the plant. You lose a lot of water in the cluster. So you get a higher concentration of juice. The berries are smaller. The clusters are smaller, and then what you get is concentration. If you go to the valley floor and you get a fertile soil and you get all the water the plant needs, you'll get huge clusters, beautiful to look at, but not nice to drink them because they are diluted. So planting on the hillside is my passion. We have been doing that. We were the first one to do it in Chile. We were meant to be crazy, you know, clearing hillsides. Out of the first 10 hectares that we cleared in our hillside, we took 300 full truckloads of stones and 300 full truckloads of trees and branches and all that. So it was a huge work and belief. We believed in what we were doing. And then we planted the Cabernet, the Syrah, the Carmenere and all that, and we got what we needed. The plant, you know, danced according to our music. So we put the amount of water that the plant needed, exactly not more than that. We got the clusters that we wanted, the size of the berries, and then we got what you tried at home. We got these wines with a certain amount of muscles.
Yeah.
You know, the tannins are velvety, are round, are approachable. They're sensual in some way. But the wines are big, you know. You need a stack with them.
They're very. It's funny because my palate's gone the other way in the last 10 years for whatever reason. I've just been drinking more feminine wines and less oak wines, and I got these wines, and I'm like, wow, I haven't had one of these in a while because they're just really. They're great. They're wonderful, but it's a totally different expression for me. But it's a lot of what you see coming from the west coast of America. In some senses, it's what you see coming from parts of Bordeaux, maybe the Left Bank. We were sitting down talking before with Jenny. I mean, in terms of being pleasurable wines, they're really pleasurable wines. I mean, yeah, you're going to want fat. You're going to want blood in your mouth. You're going to want a big steak or something braised, but just really, really, really interesting style. So what percentage now of your exports are coming to America?
America accounts for about 27% of our exports. We export 95% of our production as a whole to 110 countries of the world, and 5% remains locally. You know, in the best clubs, restaurants, hotels, we try to be at the very, very high level. You will find our wines in the most weird places in the world, like the Maldives or the Mauritius Islands or Tahiti or whatever.
That's good. You can do sail calls there. That's not a bad idea. And you're a pilot, so you can fly there.
Yeah, absolutely. and actually, we pour our wines in Japan Airways, Lufthansa, American Airways. So we have a big window to show our wines throughout the world.
So there was one of the sheets I was reading. You have this... explain this to me. I read this somewhere about you. You got, in 2009, the UK Masters of Wine Personality of the Year. I mean, that sounds epic. What does that mean? I mean, it sounds great. So you're this big personality. I mean, is it what it sounds like? Because in the wine world, we're not short of big personalities.
Well, you know that in the UK you have the Masters of Wine.
Which is crazy, right? Isabelle Legeron. We were just talking about her before. She's a MW is the little thing, which is huge. Yeah. It's like being a master somm.
Yeah.
Maybe slightly without the service aspect and maybe a little more technically rigorous.
Yeah.
It's as difficult as being, and there's only 100 and some Masters
it's so
of Wine.
Difficult.
Right.
So difficult.
Right.
And they are, you know, very specialized people. Of course, they know of wines around the world. And once the year they decide which is the prominent wine maker of the world or so. And the decision in that year was that I was doing special wines, that I was putting so much innovation in what I was doing. I was not doing the same thing that everyone was doing. I was thinking out of the box. They liked the wines, the styles that we were producing. You know, they represented, you know, the Chilean typical terroir. So I was honored with this personality of the year or winemaker of the year.
So what are you doing? Stay with that. What are you doing inside of the box? Tell me what you're doing. I'm really curious to hear what out of the box is in Chile.
Well, actually,
we could taste this. Maybe a good reference point.
Yeah, of course.
These glasses are clean. There's nothing been in them yet.
Of course. Well, first of all, we were the first one to plant hillsides, as I just told you.
Which is remarkable when you think about it, because as you said, like the families before you that had the money, you'd think if they traveled around, most of the planting in Europe is on hillsides.
Absolutely.
Right. No one's using the valley floor. And if you ask them why, they'll tell you what you just said.
Yeah.
Okay, so the hillsides is one.
Yeah, and then we refreshed our viticulture. Our viticulture was a little bit, you know, let's call it tired. Because in the middle of the 19th century, these rich families brought cuttings, you know, of Cabernets, Merlots, and so on. And they were being reproduced over and over and over and over. So they got viruses and they got some diseases. Mm. And no one, you know, noticed that, and the wines were not performing very well. So I decided to make, you know, a joint venture with Maurice and Cooter, you know, a French nursery that is controlled by the government, by the ENTAP. And I brought totally new clones and some new varieties that were inexistent in Chile, like Cabernet Franc, Petit Verdot, and Syrah. So that was thinking out of the box, you know, planting new varieties and new clones. Now today, I would define myself as a discoverer of valleys. Because I'm a pilot and I love flying, you know, from the air, I discover those slopes, expositions, little corners that are amazing to be planted. So we have been discovering lots of places that no one else ever planted. So, and we have been, luckily enough, very successful in the places we have chosen. And that was totally thinking out of the box, planting places that no one else ever did before.
Now, you still love this. You still got this passion.
I do. Totally.
I mean, it's like it's contagious. So we're doing radio, so you can't see the gentleman's face. But you could tell. I mean, I could see you like in your airplane looking out the window thinking, holy shit, that'd be a great place to plant grapes. Let's go over. Where am I? Where am I on the GPS?
Yes, absolutely.
Let me get on my phone.
And go down.
How cool.
And now the last thing that we're doing that is really amazing, we are doing a lot of work in watering. You know, the water is a big issue today.
Huge.
You know, the world is getting dry. So for the past 7 years, we have been working a lot in how to do viticulture without any irrigation or very little irrigation. And we have reached amazing results. In one estate that we own in the company, we are saving enough water for the needs of 20,000 people for one full year.
How'd you do it?
Shortened canopies.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
pruning. You know, pruning, green,
yep.
Pruning.
Yep.
One. Second, you know, we cover the rows with oak, not oak, but wood chips. Yeah. You know, that they act like a sponge. So when rain comes, you know, these chips absorb the water and they very slowly give back to the roots. We're allowing the plant to explore more because when you irrigate the plants, they get lazy.
Right.
They get lazy.
The water's at the top. I don't go for it.
Yep.
And that's another thing we talked about.
I'm forcing them.
Right. Hydric stress by driving those roots further and further and further in search of water, you're developing more terroir, more mineral.
And the last thing that it hurts my pocket, it's crop thinning, you know, taking a lot of fruit out of the plant.
Less yield per acre.
Yeah, less yield per acre. So the addition of all of this permits us to have zero irrigation in some plots of the state, not all of them, and maybe one third that the historical figures that we used to use in terms of watering.
It's a big number.
And the addition of all that is the needs of 20,000 people for a full year. That's being sustainable.
It's funny because, I mean, it's great you're doing it. It's wonderful. I travel a lot through France and I travel a lot through vineyards. And you know, in France, in the AOCs,
no
irrigation.
No.
No one's allowed to do it, period.
Yeah.
What's the soil type? I've never been to Chile. What's the soil type where I'm sure it varies, but
yeah.
Talk about where you're planting, what specific vineyards, what you're looking at. Do we have clay? Do we have lime? Do we have marl? Do we have schist? What do we have?
We have basically clay.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, we have basically clay, so that helps, you know, for the non-irrigated vineyards because clay retain much more water.
Yeah, and some varietals like Merlot love clay.
Yeah, but the important thing, Michael, is that in Chile we don't have any rain during spring and summer at all. It's a wonderful place. Of course, we have sun the whole spring and the whole summer because we have the Humboldt Current, you know, and the high pressure in the ocean. So that means that we irrigate very little compared to France because France, they have 700 millimeters of rainfall during summer. They have, you know, the Mexican Gulf Current there, and they have a lot of rain in summertime.
Yeah, in some places it can be terrible. I mean, Bordeaux, Burgundy, it can be terrible. I mean, we know Champagne is just famous for
harvest. So when they say we do not irrigate, it's well, of course, you have 700 millimeters of rain falling. You don't need to.
Yeah.
Well, we do need because we have zero. So when you start working in dry farming, when you have zero irrigation, you have to be kind of a hero because you're risking your vineyard. Your vineyard can die if you go, you know, beyond the limits.
Right, right. In the cellar, using any stainless? I mean, are your whites, is it Sauvignon Blanc, seeing oak, or stainless?
Basically stainless. We are basically stainless. So Sauvignon Blancs is only stainless steel. You know, we want to keep the fruit as strong as possible. Our Chardonnays go maybe 35% into oak barrels, where we ferment that proportion, and then the rest goes to stainless steel, and at the end we do the
combination.
The combination of both. And for red wines, we're diminishing the oak that used to be very strong, you know, following a little bit, you know, the trend of the Western
California.
California, yeah. And now we're using less and less oak. Of course, we need some because there's some micro oxygenation through the staves of the barrels.
Are you doing any micro with?
We are.
Okay.
We are doing, yeah,
soften with
a proper tool.
Right.
Yeah. As soon as the alcoholic fermentation is finished, we start a process of micro oxygenation until malolactic starts. And in that period, what we get is we strengthen we make the color strong, and we get the tannin soft.
So right before mallow.
Yeah, right before mallow, and then from mallow on, we allow the wine just to stand alone. Well, this is a Cinsault.
This is just holy moly. I mean, red fruit. It's a beautiful wine.
Yeah. This is a 35% of carbonic maceration, and the rest is just, you know, normal traditional winemaking. It's a Cinsault. It's a Southern France variety.
So carbonic, you're not crushing grape.
You're not crushing grapes.
Which is why we're getting that fruit, that expression of fruit. I mean, that's one of the hallmarks of carbonic.
Yeah, absolutely. And no oak here. No oak at all, so it's only fruit here.
No oak. It's great. It's got these really, I don't want to say leathery, but yeah, maybe leathery, these really interesting tannic. And I was trying to figure out where that tannic structure was coming from. And I was actually, I hate to do this because that's always one of the, when you're blind tasting, as we talked about before we went on the mic, like that oak question is always like, am I getting oak or am I not getting oak? And the safe answer is, unless it's really obvious, say no. But I'm not sure where I would have gone on this. So these tannins are just naturally occurring tannin from the grape.
Absolutely. And they come from a valley very south in our country. Again, we were one of the first ones to recapture. These plants are very old. They were planted at the beginning of the past century. And because there's a lot of rain there, it's in the southern part of the country. And then the viticulture was totally forgotten, and they were paying miserable prices to put this in jug wines and very basic wines.
This vines?
This, the same vines.
No way.
And then we decided to explore, to do a good vinification out of these grapes. If you treat them with tender, loving care, what would happen? And this is what happens.
It's bloody delicious. And I'm trying to think when I've had Carmenere's in and of by itself before. Is anybody doing, I know you're not, but is anybody in Chile doing non-French varietals? Has anybody planted Sangiovese or Nebbiolo?
There is some. There is some. I got a little bit of Riesling by the coast where the cold temperature is. There is tiny bits of Nebbiolos, tiny bit of Sangiovese that is not performing very well. Mm. Sangiovese is a very strong variety, and you need really poor soils and schist, you know, poor soils to achieve that. And but I would say the rest, it's 99% French varieties, mainly Bordeaux, Burgundy, and now quite trendy Southern France, like Carignan, Mourvèdre, Grenache, Cinsault.
Yeah, well, there's, I mean, We've seen those again, that we've seen all those varietals have become really, really popular. How do you see you? I know you go back and forth a lot. How do you see the wine scene in America today? I'm just curious to get your take as someone that's flying up from the Southern Hemisphere. I mean, I shouldn't even say America. Let me just say New York, because the New York wine scene is pretty unique. But I've been here since 1982, and I'd say in the last 15, 16 years, we've really become like a wine capital in this city. Like when you walk around, when you see wine lists at restaurants, when you go to retail stores, I used to come back from Europe and say, God, you know, I would drink these great wines in Paris, I would drink these great wines in Italy, and I'd come back and you couldn't find them on the shelves. They weren't existed. And now I've got friends that are coming here from Paris saying, how the hell did you get that? I can't get this in Paris for my wine bar, because so many people want to. I mean, just as a question off of topic, I suppose, in a way, but not so much. What do you think of the wine scene in New York today? Because it's crazy.
Well, it is a capital, of course, of wine. Yeah, well, you have the influence of Europe. You're just in front of Europe. Yeah. We're far away from Europe. And when I started, you know, long ago, I started already 40 years ago in winemaking, you know, to sell a bottle of wine in New York was really tough. To get an appointment was tough, and people were not too much interested. They were in heavy alcohols or very basic. You can remember the Chablis or those very that they were just combination of the remaining of the tanks. No real knowledge about the varieties and all of that. And I've seen a sophistication in the New Yorkers in the way they drink and the amount they drink. When I started, you know, the average per capita was about 3 or 4 liters. I'm afraid today you are close to 12.
No, it's great. We are. We're one of the only places on the planet, I think, where we're actually our consumption is growing. Yeah. All over Europe, it's going down. Quick question. What's going to be next for you? What are you stoked about in terms of a project with your winery? Is there something on the horizon, a new varietal you're playing with, a new blend, a new piece of equipment?
Well, we are always looking.
A new parcel that you've flown over?
I think that the best for me is new terroirs.
Okay.
Because we have been exploring already so many varietals. Now, pieces of equipment, you know, brings you a little bit more of technology, which is okay, but it doesn't change your life.
This is extraordinary.
But when you find the correct place to plant a vineyard, that's bingo. That's where you really hit the spot.
Aurelio Montes has been my guest. You can find his wines throughout the United States, Montes. We're drinking this Carmenere. This is so... Carignan, sorry, I'm reading a note and drinking a wine. So delicious. The ones you sent me are great, big, vivacious, like you. These big personality wines.
Well, thank
you. They're just this big smile. Keep up the great work. You obviously love what you're doing. Thanks so much for coming in. Glad we could get you in today.
Well, it's been a real pleasure to...
My pleasure.
And I realize that your knowledge in wine is amazing.
No, I just drink and hang out with people like you that know what they're talking about. Thank you
so much.
So stay tuned again next week. I've got Virgilio Martinez in a pre-tape, his restaurant Central. It's great. He's cool. It's a full hour show. All of that Lima, Peru, and the amazing, I mean, your neighbors, the amazing scene that's going on down there. Stay tuned for that, and I'll see you in 2 weeks live.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.